Atlantic, but Sabodin could make out one of the enemy cruisers, closing in fast on the Silent Horseman's port side. The intership Vox was down, and few of the crew were capable of manning their stations. Sabodin hauled himself towards his command throne. The tacticum display flickered in and out, but he could read the situation regardless. The enemy were within range, and the Silent Horseman was wounded. Down below, fresh crew were dragging aside the dead and manning empty stations. Sabodin watched them, regret gnawing at him. If they'd had more time, just a few moments.
Sabodin,
Kanem said softly. Sabodin looked up. The enemy was still closing on the Silent Horseman, but now, standing firm between them, was the battered shape of Orlander's Wrath.
Kiel,
Kanem said, and it sounded like a sigh. Sabodin looked at him, and Kanem shook his head. Sabodin felt a chill and turned back to the viewscreen. The weapons batteries of Orlander's Wrath vomited silent fire, and one of the enemy ships twisted like a wounded wolf and fell away, dying. The heavy cruiser spat death full in the face of the enemy, and brief blooms of hateful light shivered in the dark as escorts were consumed by the fusillade.
Vox them! Watch on us! Now!
Sabodin said, half in wonder, watching as Kiel set himself against the foe. Static rasped across the Vox. Motes of fire danced across the black. Then, Kiel's voice, thin with fatigue and distorted by static.
If you're going to go, Khan, now is the time. Our firing tubes are dry, and we're being held together by prayers and good intentions. We can't hold them off much longer.
You are a brave man, Commodore Captain, Sabodin said.
He relaxed slowly, hands flexing. Kanem wouldn't meet his gaze, and he wondered if the Shaman had foreseen this moment.
Make it count, is all I ask. Save Almes. They're diverting power to forward engines, Kanem murmured. She's an old bitch, but she's got a bit of bite left.
Kiel continued. Sabodin knew that the captain was no longer speaking to him.
They're going to feel it. Emperor, damn me if they don't. They're going to know who we are. All ahead, full!
As he heard Kiel's command, Sabodin barked orders, hoping he had enough crew left to see them enacted. The deck shuddered as the battle barge began to withdraw. Battered escorts closed in, shielding the larger vessel. Not many of those left either. He looked at Kanem.
The spirits told you this would happen, didn't they?
Kanem nodded.
I saw the skull beneath his skin, he said.
On the viewscreen, Orlander's Wrath arrowed ponderously towards the closest of the enemy cruisers. The crimson vessels continued to fire, lashing the oncoming ship with waves of punishment. But she didn't stop. When the impact came, it was akin to the birth of a new star. A flash of brilliant white, splitting the dark in two. The command deck shook as the reverberations of the conflagration rippled outwards through the void. Klaxons whooped, and crew fought to compensate as the light swelled, filling the viewscreen. A halo of fire radiated in all directions. Smaller vessels were consumed instantly, swept aside as if by the hand of a giant.
Status!
Sabodin asked as the glare faded. Damage reports rolled in. He looked around the bridge, seeing only corpses and smoke. He bent his head, suddenly weary. The remaining enemy vessel listed badly. It had been caught at the edge of the conflagration, and was in no shape to pursue. Part of him wanted to finish the task, to break it, to take a toll of scalps in payment for Kiel and the others.
Orders, my lord!
A serf coughed. Sabodin was silent for long moments, weighing his choices. Then, with a grunt, he said,
Bring us about! Broadcast a new heading to all surviving ships!
He slumped back into his command throne. There was blood in his armor and in his mouth. Even as Kanem had foreseen, he swallowed and looked at the shaman. Canem's face was a mask of bruises and blood, but his eyes were determined. He nodded. Sir Bowden laid his tulwar across his knees. He would not sheathe it until the battle was done, one way or another.
Set course for Almace.
Chapter 16, 800440. Almace, Primaris Grade, Cardinal World. Aemon listened as his officers spoke, but took little of it in. Outside, the sky was the colour of an open wound, and crowded with aircraft. Every aristocrat with sense was getting out of the line of fire. They were fleeing the city in droves, heading for estates in the mountains or valleys. Most, he knew, would drag the earth over themselves until the shooting had stopped. Then they would seek to deal with the victor. Though the thought repulsed him on a spiritual level, he could not find it in himself to judge them too harshly. He wanted to flee himself, but where was there to go? And in any event, he could not abandon his charge. The thought of the anchorite sent a pulse of fear through him. Calder would know by now, or soon enough. Then what? Execution, perhaps? It wasn't fair. But what was in these trying times? He closed his eyes and tried to calm the thudding of his heart. The strategium chamber echoed with the sounds of petty disagreement. Half of the officers were noble-born, and they bristled at having a man like Tyre in command. Ordinarily, it was kept under control, but tension had a way of widening the cracks. Long-simmering resentments were coming to light, and Tyre wasn't helping matters. He heard the swordmaster curse and bellow, and his aristocratic subordinates return fire. They wanted to concentrate the defences on the estates and properties of their clans. Those officers whose only family was the ecclesiarchy disagreed. Tyre fought to calm both sides in his usual manner, by insulting both parties. Back and forth it went, all of them steadfastly ignoring the fact that none of them were in charge, and when it came down to it, Calder would determine where and when the companies of the regiment mobilised. "You look ill." Aemon opened his eyes. Canoness Law was studying him with her usual flat gaze. She stood beside his seat as always, her hands clasped behind her back. He could not tell what was going on in her head. Had never been able to, in fact. He'd always found her impassivity oddly comforting. "Are you worried?" he asked, forcing a smile. Her expression didn't change. "If you perish, morale will suffer." Aemon snorted and tried to pay attention to the argument, but it all seemed so pointless. Law was still looking at him. Her eyes pierced him to the quick. They narrowed slightly. "What is it, my lord?" she murmured intently, leaning close. Aemon hesitated. Law knew that there was a secret at Almace's heart, though not what it was. She knew that it was his responsibility, and by extension hers, to guard it, and she took that responsibility very seriously. For an instant, just one, he considered ordering her to eliminate the threat. She would do it, he knew. She would do it with a hymn on her lips. She would kill Calder, whatever the cost, all to preserve the secret. But he could not say the words, could not ask her to do such a thing, could not bring himself to commit such treachery, even in good cause. He shook his head. "Nothing," he said softly. "Not sleeping well. I'll be fine." "You drink too much," she said bluntly. "That is why you do not sleep." He forced a smile and nodded. "Perhaps you are right. Excuse me." He stood. Officers turned, some making to rise. He waved them back to their seats. "Keep talking, gentlemen. I am listening." As the argument resumed, he went to the window and looked out over the city. His city. Beautiful and sad in equal measure. There was so much he'd wanted to do. Reforms he'd hoped to implement. It took time. It always took time. But now, there was no time. He bowed his head and tried to pray, but couldn't think of the words. He looked up. at the face of the god emperor, captured in coloured glass. A proud face, wise and kind. He knew that this depiction was based on his own great-grandfather. No one alive could remember what the Emperor of Mankind had truly looked like. Even the official accounts differed. Every writer seemed to have his or her own idea of who the God Emperor had been. Amon, as a theologian, had his own thoughts on the matter. They were often contradictory, and he had yet to write them down. But he'd always intended to compose a monograph on the subject of such diverse perceptions and their meaning for the faithful. But it seemed blasphemous to even consider the subject with anything less than fervent awe. It seemed blasphemous to question. But he couldn't help it. His life had been full of questions from the very beginning. Things were no simpler now than before. The anchorite cautioned him to have faith, but faith in what? The God Emperor? Calder? Or maybe himself? Questioning his own decisions had become second nature to him. A planetary governor, even a cardinal governor, could not afford to act on impulse. Too much depended on his decisions. His first instinct was to ensure that the anchorite remained a secret. But another part of him wondered if it was not meant to be. Why else would Gilliman have sent Calder and the others unless it was to protect the anchorite? This world, this system, meant little in the greater scheme of things. Past the glass, he saw the faint impression of the refugee vessels crowding the suborbital docking spires. Hundreds of them, mostly small. The larger ones hadn't made it. Rather than thousands of survivors, there were hundreds, all bringing their own stories of terror and armoured monsters. Lore had been against letting them dock. She'd insisted they were tainted. Their survival proved that they had succumbed to the blandishments of demons. Only by agreeing to allow her sororitas to debrief the survivors, overseen by the Imperial Fists, had he managed to keep her from massacring them wholesale. He glanced surreptitiously at her. She was watching the arguing officers like a hawk, her hand tapping at the haft of her power maul. Tyre looked at her every so often, and Amon knew something was passing between them. Finally, she snatched her power maul up, activated it, and slammed it down, cracking the table and silencing the military officers. "Enough!" she snarled. "The canoness is correct," Amon said, seizing on the silence. He looked around the table, meeting the gaze of every man and woman in uniform. "I have a planetary sermon to give. I expect this matter to be resolved by the time I have completed it. Otherwise, I will turn over command of the armies to the canoness." Tyre sat back, smiling crookedly.
"Suits me,"
he said, with an air of triumph. Lore laughed harshly, and her eyes blazed with interest as she took in the suddenly very nervous officers. "A burden I will bear gladly," she purred. Amon nodded. "I leave you to it, then." His bodyguards fell into step with him as he swept from the chamber. He allowed himself a small smile. If only all such difficulties were so easily handled. Data spooled across the Strategium feed. Sensor telemetry, auger feeds, long-range calculations. Reports by private vessels. All of it saying the same thing. The enemy was at the gates. Time was up. Their fleet was smaller than it had been, but still large enough to lay siege to Almais, providing they successfully navigated the asteroid belt. Calder felt something akin to satisfaction. It was good that the moment had arrived. Now he would see whether his preparations were enough. He turned from the projection and activated an encrypted command channel.
"Capulus, report!"
The vox squalled and whined for long moments until a voice replied.
"Strike cruiser Capulus, moving into final position, Lieutenant."
"Good. Wait until the enemy have taken up orbit before launching strikes. Concentrate on the southern hemisphere. Maintain vox silence."
He paused.
"If the battle turns, withdraw from the system. Return to the crusade."
There was a pointed silence, and then...
"And tell them what?"
"That we failed." "Noted. Dawn be with you, Lieutenant." And with you, Capulus.
Cowder cut the channel. The Capulus would wait just out of sensor range, behind one of Almace's moons. When they arrived, the strike cruiser would do what it could. They all would. Whatever came, they would not be found wanting. He turned again to the sensor feed from the asteroid mining facilities. Karros had managed to calm things down significantly, but they were still tense. The Raven Guard's last report had mentioned that he was entering talks with the leaders of the uprising. He flicked through the feed, cycling farther and farther out from the facilities, to the very edge of the asteroid belt. And there, in the distance, a gleam of light, growing steadily brighter.
I estimate a day, maybe two.
Calder stiffened. He hadn't heard Solaro enter the chamber. The Reaver seemed to have no more substance than a shadow when he put his mind to it.
Report!
You were right,
Solaro said. Calder turned. The Raven Guard stood a respectful distance away, at the foot of the dais. Calder gestured for him to ascend.
He's hiding something. Took me a few days, but I followed him to a vault, or perhaps a crypt, hidden at the heart of this place. The locks are biometrically encrypted.
Other defences?
They spoke over one of the dozen encrypted Vox channels that the Raven Guard employed. To anyone capable of listening in, it would simply sound like static.
Combat servitors. Antiques. Easy enough to slip past.
Solaro shrugged.
I could do it again, if you like. With a few skin samples, I could beat the encryption.
Calder paused, considering.
What else?
It was Solaro's turn to pause.
He was talking to someone.
Who?
I couldn't determine that. Himself, perhaps? Or maybe a prisoner?
Why do you say that?
Who else would you keep sealed away like that?
Calder nodded. A fair point. Solaro leaned back against the rail of the dais, the very picture of ease. The Reaver had an informal manner. Karros seemed to encourage a certain lack of discipline in his warriors.
Would you like me to procure a skin sample?
Solaro went on.
I can be in and out within the hour.
No. Did you record your discovery?
Solaro hesitated. Calder gestured.
I know you record everything. Give it to me, please.
Solaro sighed and extracted a data spike from a hidden port in his vambrace. Calder took it and weighed it contemplatively on his palm.
What are you going to do?
Solaro asked. Calder closed his fist gently about the data spike.
Deal with the matter directly, but politely, as a Huskarl should. Where is Aemon now?
The pulpit,
Solaro said. It wasn't the chamber's official title, but it suited it well enough. The Cathedral Palace's central voxcaster station occupied the uppermost spires of the structure, where blue skies began to give way to the troposphere. Calder turned.
Come with me.
They made their way quickly to the central transit shaft, despite the crowded corridors. Since the enemy fleet had been sighted, the Cathedral Palace had seen a boom in its population. Not just troops, but scribes and officials. They packed the corridors of power, shouting to be seen and heard by the Cardinal Governor's staff. The Lord Deacons of the outlying cities wanted reinforcements. Representatives from the trade unions wanted the bulwarks pulled down, or more of them put up, in their competitors' territories. Lay priests and missionaries demanded the Cardinal Governor's ear, and the spokespeople for the noble families wanted to be evacuated. Despite the furore, the crowds parted before Calder. Scribes and noblemen alike scrambled from his path as he made his way down the main artery of the Cathedral Palace, Solaro trailing in his wake. Any not fast enough were shoved aside, if gently. Cyber cherubs followed at a discreet distance, artificial eyes recording everything.
I hate those things,
Solaro murmured as they entered the transit platform. Both Primaris wore their helms and spoke through the vox.
They should know better than to spy on us. It is almost heresy.
They should know better than to do many things, and yet they do them all the same.
Solaro laughed.
True enough.
He looked at Calder.
They can't tell us apart, you know. The humans, I mean.
We're human.
Unaugmented humans.
Are they colorblind?
Solaro studied him for a moment.
They can't tell the difference between a Primaris and a brother of the First Founding.
I suppose, to a child, all giants look alike.
Solaro grunted.
My brothers can tell the difference.
As can mine. But then, we are not children.
Calder looked at him. He wondered why Solaro was confiding in him. Perhaps it was simply that they were both Primaris. It was easier to talk to someone who understood, even if they wore a different heraldry.
They will accept you in time. It might be decades or centuries, but there will come a day when there is no difference between us.
They think I am to replace them.
You are, as every recruit is meant to replace a veteran.
Solaro was silent for a moment. Then,
have they accepted you?
Calder didn't reply. The transit platform juddered to a halt, and the doors opened. The hall beyond led directly to the pulpit. The corridor was mostly glass, save for the marble floor. The glass was void-hardened, and the frames that held the panes looked like gold, but were actually made from a ferroceramite blend. The pulpit extended off the side of the spire. It was a circular chamber, its outer walls studded with vox antenna and aerial relays. From within, a voice could be sent from one side of the planet to the other, as well as to the vessels in orbit. To either side and above, the skies were visible, as well as the orbital docking platforms that stretched upwards into the black. Tiny motes that were ships moved across the heavens, seeking safe berths against the encroaching storm. Calder watched them for a moment. The docklands of Almace were not so large as some he'd seen. Compared to those of Terra, they were barely there at all. But they were large enough to provide a tempting target for the enemy. The docklands had their own defences, several wings of attack craft and macro cannon batteries, enough to see off a casual raid. There was no telling if they would survive what was coming. Calder had ordered several squads of intercessors to lend their efforts to the defences. Hopefully, they would be enough. Aemon's guards were waiting for them at the end of the corridor. The Crusaders didn't move as Calder approached. He stopped as they raised their shields and locked them together. He detected the slight hum of a power field.
I need to speak with him.
They didn't move, nor did they speak. Tyre had mentioned something about a vow of silence, though he hadn't given any particulars. Calder suspected he knew the reason. Behind him, he heard the sound of a combat blade being drawn from its sheath. The Crusaders tensed. Calder waved Solaro back.
No,
he said. He studied the Crusaders, a man and a woman this time, by their body language. Both tall, their forms hidden beneath carapace armour and heavy robes, and their faces obscured behind featureless helms. He didn't want to kill them. He held up the data spike.
I know, he said simply. I know what he's hiding. I would speak with him. Let me pass.
The slightest of twitches was the only sign that they'd heard his words. His battle plate detected the faint murmur of an encrypted vox conversation, and he relaxed slightly. He knew that they would stand aside. A moment later, he was proven right. The shield parted. Calder glanced at Solaro.
Stay here.
He stepped past the guards into the pulpit. The chamber was circular with a high, vaulted roof. The walls were covered in vox recorders and relay equipment, and a dais occupied the centre of the floor. The dais was surrounded by a palisade of vox casters, each manned by a robed acolyte. Several of these glanced fearfully at Calder as he entered, but Aemon waved them to stillness as he completed his latest address to the planetary population.
And we will persevere, my friends, for that is our holy sovereign's will. Have no doubt of that. The time of tribulation is upon us, and we will not be found wanting. Go in glory, my children, and stay in peace.
The Cardinal Governor stepped back as a triumphal ode started up. A choir of acolytes began to sing into a set of smaller voxcasters just below the dais. As their voices swelled, Aemon joined Calder.
A good speech.
I have some small skill in that regard, I admit.
Aemon looked around.
That it should have to come to this. I cannot help but feel this is the Emperor's judgment upon us. Upon me.
And have you done something to deserve his wrath?
Aemon smiled bitterly.
A straightforward way of asking me what I'm hiding, Lieutenant. Then I expect no less from a son of Dorn.
He paused.
You had one of your warriors follow me, to the crypts at the heart of the city.
He glanced at Calder, as if expecting a denial. Calder nodded.
I did.
He held up the data spike.
He recorded what he saw.
Aemon looked away. His shoulders slumped, not with resignation, but with something Calder thought might have been relief.
And?
He asked softly.
Answer my question.
Or what?
Aemon asked. There was no defiance there, Calder judged. Simply curiosity. As if Aemon wished to know all the facts before making a decision. It was as if he had been expecting this moment for a long time.
Or I will confine you to your quarters and breach the crypt. I have no more time for these games. I need to know what's in there.
You won't kill me.
To execute you at this juncture would be to risk a civil revolt. If this city falls, it will not be due to my foolishness.
Calder looked down at him.
It would make things significantly easier if you were to simply tell me.
Aemon laughed softly.
Yes, I expect so.
He looked at the data spike.
You were more cunning than I gave you credit for. Then maybe this is the God Emperor's will.
He sighed.
Answer me this. What are the chances of our survival at this moment, if all goes well?
Calder answered immediately.
48%.
Aemon raised an eyebrow.
That's a bit higher than I expected.
He shook his head.
And yet, not high enough to be a certainty. Very well.
He looked at Calder.
I will take you to the anchorite. And may the God Emperor have mercy on my soul and yours.
Almais, Primus Asteroid Facilities. It had taken a long time for the miners to decide on a spokesperson. Karos found it heartening. The lack of a leader implied that this was no organized rebellion, but instead a populist revolt. So far, he had seen little to indicate that there was anything more sinister than unhappy labourers to blame for the situation. That meant it could be dealt with quickly. The enforcers occupied the outer facilities, while the miners had been allowed to maintain control of the inner facility and transit paths. This arrangement sat well with neither side, but there was an equilibrium to it, so long as the Raven Guard occupied the middle ground. The factions had decided to meet in the no man's land between the outer and inner facility, a labyrinth of gantries and causeways that stretched in all directions. Karos stood on a platform at the heart of the web of steel, the commander of the enforcer detachment beside him.
They're here,
Regulator Galba said. Galba was a heavy-set man, ill-shaped for the tight confines of the mining facility. He gestured towards an approaching gravshunt with his shock maul.
I am aware. I detected them some time ago,
Karos said.
We should take them into custody as soon as they step onto this platform.
Karos looked down at the man.
We will not.
Galba shifted nervously.
I said that we should, not that we would.
Karos studied the man for a moment longer. He didn't particularly care for Galba. The Regulator was a brute and a simpleton, the perfect commander for a punishment garrison. But this was no longer a punishment garrison. It was the front line. He turned away as the shunt came to a stop. Spiros whistled softly. Karos glanced up. Figures in hazard suits and ash cloaks crowded the highest gantries, just out of Orspec's range. Galba saw them a moment later. He cursed and groped for his sidearm.
Ambush! I knew it! Can't trust these stinking...
Kara silenced him with a gesture.
If it were an ambush, they would have already started shooting. Likely they are here to prevent you from doing as you just suggested. Now be silent.
He stepped forward to meet the miner's representative. Startled, she stumbled and fell back. He looked down at her, scanning her features and comparing them to the pic captures of facility labourers.
Reyes, he said. Sedalia Reyes, Warloader Primus class.
She was dark, for a Voidborn, and compact. She wore an Warloader's body glove and had a gear belt cinched about her waist. A number of tools hung from it, including a plasma cutter. The thin, blade-like device was meant for cutting through solid rock or metal. She also had an autogun slung across her shoulder. She stared up at him, eyes wide. Karos reached out his hand.
I am Lieutenant Karos of the Raven Guard.
Reyes averted her eyes as Karos drew her to her feet.
You're bigger than I thought, she mumbled
as she adjusted the autogun.
I've never seen one of you before.
I am considered small for my rank,
Karos said. She gawped at him.
What?
Never mind.
He paused.
You are brave to meet us in the open.
Someone had to, my lord,
she added quickly. She straightened and said,
What did you want to say to us?
Karos let the red gaze of his helm play across the catwalks and gantries surrounding him before answering. There were hundreds of them now, some young, some old. He knew that Spyros and the others could kill them all, if he gave the order, but to do so would be a waste and required too much time.
The system is under attack. The enemies of man ride fast upon the gates of Almais. You stand between your world and the ships of the foe.
Not my world, Reyes spat, suddenly defiant. This here is my world. Just this. I'm void-born and bred.
You are an Imperial citizen, rock-cur!
Galba snarled, raising his shock maul.
And you will do a citizen's duty!
Quiet!
Karos rumbled. Galba blanched and stepped back. Karos looked at Reyes.
They will take these facilities as well. Almais alone will not satisfy them.
There's thousands of leagues of tunnels, she said, half-heartedly.
And how long can you hold out when you lose access to hydroponics and the hydrogen recyclers, or when they begin exposing parts of the facility to the vacuum? We can survive that. You cannot.
Karos released her.
If you wish to have any hope of survival, you will listen to me.
What about our grievances?
Karos paused. She was brave, if nothing else.
And what grievances would these be?
They were going to abandon us, Reyes said.
She glared at Galba as she spoke.
Seal the facility, destroy the generators, and leave us to suffocate. That's why we took over.
Protocol demands,
Galba began, his face flushed.
Protocol is suspended,
Karos said.
You are both hereby seconded to my command, by order of the Cardinal Governor.
He boosted his vox.
You are all hereby placed under my authority. You are no longer miners or revolutionaries. You are soldiers. If you cannot fight, some other task will be found for you. But from this moment on, you answer to me. I will now give you a moment to voice any objections you might have.
Galba coughed.
My lord, this is highly questionable. These rock cures can't...
Karos gestured. Spyros caught Galba by the skull and twisted. The regulator gave a little squawk as his bones snapped. His boot heels thudded against the floor as Spyros let him slump. Chain and the others raised their bolt guns, covering the remaining enforcers. Karos nodded.
Objections noted.
He looked down at Reyes.
What about you?
No, my lord,
she whispered, staring at Galba's body.
Good.
He turned to the enforcers.
Which of you is second in command?
One of them stepped forward, somewhat hesitantly.
Enforcer Desh, my lord,
he said, with a shaky salute. Karos reached down and tore the sigil of rank from Galba's sleeve. He extended the patch to Desh.
You are now regulator, Desh. Do a better job than your predecessor, and you might even survive.
He turned, letting his red gaze play across the crowded gantries.
That goes for all of you. Obey my orders, and you may well live to continue your labours. Disobey and die, either at the hands of the enemy or mine. Those are your only choices.
He drew his bolt pistol and hefted it meaningfully.
I suggest you decide quickly.
Almes, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. The bulkhead hissed open, releasing a gust of chill, stale air. Ancient recyclers kicked on, stirring the atmosphere. Calder followed Aemon into the dimly lit chamber, his auto-senses immediately registering a towering presence to his left. He turned, hand falling automatically to his sidearm.
You wanted to see what I have been hiding, Aemon said. Here he is, Lieutenant Calder. Meet the Anchorite.
Welcome.
The voice was at once awful and comforting. Calder paused, hand on his weapon, as the Anchorite, huge and monstrous, stepped into the light. The ancient Contemptor Dreadnought was a towering presence, bipedal and hulking, with only the basest resemblance to a human shape. A giant of ceramite and iron. A war machine from a forgotten age, its hull marked with sigils of purity and prayer scrolls. Its arms ended in two great, crushing claws that flexed and whined idly. Calder stared. Contemptor dreadnoughts were rare these days. The machine bore no heraldry, and no colours. It was grey and bare of all ornamentation. The ancient war machine observed him with glowing optical sensors, but made no move towards him.
You are a new thing under the sun.
He rumbled.
Have all of the sons of Dawn grown so in stature over the centuries of my isolation? No, we are a new breed, or perhaps an old one, depending.
Calder pulled his hand away from his bolt pistol.
Who are you? Young Aemon told you. I am the Anchorite. Your name? I have no name. The man I was is dead. I am all that stands here, a humble bearer of words. Look, see.
Lumens flickered to life, revealing the walls and the innumerable lines of script carved into them. Calder looked from the walls to the dreadnought.
Bearer of words, he said flatly.
A sudden anger pulsed in him. He thought he knew now why Aemon had been so reluctant to reveal this particular secret.
A peculiar phrase,
he looked at Aemon.
Explain now. Leave him, son of Dawn. This is not Aemon's doing, not the doing of his ancestors. They are here and have been my captors, my hosts, for longer than you have been as you are, and not by their choice, I assure you. Who are you to assure me of anything? A nameless traitor hidden in the heart of this city. By rights, I should execute you both.
He tried to hold Aemon's gaze, but the Cardinal Governor shook his head and looked away.
Do you know what an Anchorite is, boy?
Something in the Dreadnought's tone brought Calder up short.
I am not familiar with the term, no, he said after a moment.
A quick tactical analysis told him that if the Anchorite decided to attack, there was little he could do to harm the war machine. Listening was the best of bad options.
A man of faith, who confines himself so as to become closer to his god. That is what an anchorite is, and that is who I am. And who is your god?
Calder asked.
Who do you think, boy?
The anchorite leaned close.
There is only one god in this universe, and he sits upon a throne of gold.
Calder stared up at the dreadnought, momentarily nonplussed.
What? The god emperor, boy. It's in the title.
The anchorite made a sound that might have been a sigh.
Theology was never your legion's strong suit. Good at building, but not thinking, as Lorga used to say.
Another soft, hissing sigh.
Lorga. Salvation and damnation in one. Poor, foolish Lorga. He couldn't see that it was a test of our devotion, of our faith. Then, none of us did. Except you,
Calder asked.
Not even me. Not at first. I was as angry as any of them. I thought, how dare he deny us his truest sons? How dare he cast our works into the dust? But things changed at Kalth.
The anchorite raised his talons and studied them.
I saw what we were doing, down there in the dark, and thought it only just an eye for an eye. The scions of Ultramar had torn down our temples and shattered our fanes, had put the faithful to the sword. Was it not just to seek recompense? To meet like with like?
The dreadnought turned, ancient servos whirring.
Then an epiphany, a crash of understanding amid the tumult of war. I saw the futility of it all. Ouroboros, the serpent that devours its own tail. They broke us, and we sought to break them. But we have become stronger for the breaking, and so too might they. And then what? More wars? More vengeance meted out across the tapestry of the galaxy?
There was a sound. Calder wondered if the ancient warrior was laughing, or weeping. The anchorite stretched out a claw and touched the words etched into the metal of his cell. There was something almost wistful in the gesture.
I saw then that the cycle could end only one way. So I stopped. I set aside my blade and bent my knee. I waited for my cousins, for Gilliman's sons, to kill me there in the dark. And they might have, but fate had other plans in store. They spared you,
Calder said in disbelief. None of this made any sense. It was madness. And yet, the evidence was before him.
In a manner of speaking.
The anchorite made a sound that Calder was now certain was laughter.
I was put in chains and interred in an oubliette, left to rot for the rest of that war. When my brothers broke themselves on the walls of terror, I sat in the dark and prayed for their souls. Things answered me, seeking to sway me from my penance. But I am no stranger to such spirits. The deserts of Colchis were thick with them, like fleas on a cur's back. I banished them from me and continued my prayers.
A sudden thought occurred to Calder.
This time we speak of, you were not interred in a dreadnought then? No. That came later.
Calder glanced at Aemon. The Cardinal Governor cleared his throat. The anchorite attempted to take his own life, not the first time, but the most successful, necessitating the procurement of an amniotic sarcophagus. Calder had trouble fathoming such a thing. He turned to look at the hulking dreadnought. The ancient warrior seemed to slump, as if in shame.
"Why? I am weak," the dreadnought turned. "We were all weak. Weak of soul, weak of body and will. We allowed all that we had built to fall to ruin, for the lies of a few. Absolution lies only in death," Calder recited. "Indeed, cousin, but my absolution is denied me. Century upon century I persist. I share my wisdom with those of the true faith. The faith my brothers, my gene father, turn from."
Calder paused, wondering if he'd heard correctly.
"You share your wisdom? I was quite the scribe in my youth. I wrote down the pronouncements of the holy and committed every prayer to memory. I read one of the first copies of the Lectitio Divinitatis, that most sacred of texts. See, here, the great passages inscribed upon these walls. Is it not beautiful?"
Calder felt a chill race through him, though he could not say why. He turned, truly seeing the markings for the first time. He looked at Aemon, seeking some answer to a question he could not voice. "The anchorite has been one of the voices guiding the ecclesiarchy from the beginning," the cardinal governor said softly. "So much of what we are is thanks to him, though we have diverged somewhat in recent centuries." Aemon's smile was a brittle thing. Calder wondered what it must have been like for a mortal to learn that the origins of his faith lie in the ramblings of a mad legionary, confined to a war machine.
"All rivers must find their own way," the anchorite said. "Such is the nature of faith." "How?" Calder asked. "How? How did any of this happen?" "Mercy," the anchorite said. "The future is always born in mercy. It's giving, or the lack of it. Gilliman spared me. I do not know why. Maybe he saw what I saw, that the way forward could not be built on a foundation of treachery and vengeance. Or maybe..."
He trailed off, servos grinding, as he turned away from Calder.
"I do not know. I know only that I persist, and in persisting am driven to speak, to share what I learned that day."
The anchorite fell silent. Calder felt a peculiar flash of pity for the ancient warrior.
"He did not speak of you," he said.
"What?"
The anchorite's head turned, gears protesting.
"Gilliman, he did not speak of you when I was assigned this task. Why?
How should I know? Perhaps he has forgotten me."
A dull rumble of mechanical laughter followed.
"That would be fitting, I think. A fair reward for one such as I."
"He has not forgotten you," Aemon said softly.
Calder looked at him. Aemon cleared his throat. "After our initial request for aid was ignored, I used a certain code sequence devised by the Primarch when the anchorite was first given into my ancestors' keeping." Aemon traced his fingers across one of the litanies, scratched into the wall.
He knew, even then, that the arch-enemy would come for their prodigal brother. Perhaps not for millennia, but eventually.
He looked at Calder, his eyes wet with unshed tears.
"And now they have."
He swallowed.
I knew the moment we were cut off, the moment contact with the other systems was lost, that the day had come around at last. So I sent a message, hoping that it would find him. Find you.
Eamon's voice was thick with emotion. There was fear there, and grief, but also hope. Calder understood. He looked at the anchorite.
We lack the manpower and resources to resist a conventional siege for long. It will be anything but a conventional siege, I suspect.
The anchorite shifted his weight, and the cell shook.
My brothers and I espoused a different philosophy of war to most. We believed the quickest blow was best. Dig for the vitals immediately.
He gestured with a claw for emphasis.
If they are here for me, they will attack the Cathedral Palace. That will be their focus, to the exclusion of all else. So I have surmised.
Calder turned to Eamon.
We will need to isolate the Cathedral Palace. I had hoped to use it as a supply route between France, but if their end goal is to require your...
guest, Eamon interjected.
Prisoner, Calder went on. Then we must prevent that at all costs. We will need to split the city, destroy transit routes, seal access paths and barricade every gate and tunnel. Parts of the city must be sacrificed to save the whole.
His mind was already conducting the necessary calculations. His earlier strategies were nothing but ash now. New ones would be required. In a way, it was a relief. It was a simpler thing to defend one area than an entire city. Necessary resources could be freed up and put to better use elsewhere, and new defensive measures implemented. But there was no time to complete them all before the enemy arrived. Some would have to be done under fire. He spared only a brief thought for those he'd impressed into service to defend Lowtown. Their sacrifice was more necessary now than ever. The blood they would shed would buy him the time he needed to make the Cathedral Palace inviolate. His own blood, too, come to that, and that of his warriors, and Karos and Sabodan, and Eamon as well. All their lives were mortar for his walls. In the end, that was a price he was more than willing to pay for victory. Chapter 17 830030 Odoacer System, Corward Edge. The Matnim slumped in his command throne, watching the end of his quest approach. Almace was a vibrant orb, even at a distance. It was ringed by a wide halo of stellar debris, asteroids and dust turning with infinitesimal slowness, like a great wheel. Beyond it, an array of orbital defences and dockyards crowned the world.
Beautiful, is it not?
He said to Apis. The other word-bearer stood nearby, hands clasped behind his back, the very image of the soldier at rest.
It looks like a target to me.
But a beautiful one.
Amatnim studied the hololithic data feeds from the long-range augers. The orbital defences were archaic but well-maintained, unlike those they'd encountered above Pergamon. The fleet would take heavy losses just getting into position, and there were few of them left as it was. But it would be worth it in the end. And besides, the gods only promised glory, not that you would live to claim it. He'd given orders for the rest of the fleet to take up an approach formation to navigate the debris field. The sooner they were through, the better. The Glory Eternal anchored the centre, with the remaining cruisers to either side. Frigates and pirate vessels ranged ahead and on the flanks. Assault craft arrowed in front, hunting the foe. Apis coughed discreetly, alerting him to the presence of a newcomer. Amatnim didn't turn.
What do you want, Lacomhue?
Kellim has not reported in,
Lacomhue said from behind his throne.
Don't you have an assault to be preparing for, brother?
Others can oversee the chattel. I wish to speak to you before the end.
Ermatnim glanced up at the Dark Apostle. Lacomhue wasn't looking at him, but at the viewscreen. Yattle stood behind him, alongside Lacomhue's remaining bladeslave. The creature glared at Ermatnim and shifted its weight, as if in anticipation of an attack. Yattle's gaze was unreadable, though he had his helm clasped under his arm. Ermatnim smiled and turned away.
"Speak then, O worthy emissary of the gods! Unburden your soul, I beg you."
Lacomhue grunted.
"Kellim has not reported in."
"So you said."
"Are you not concerned?"
"Not particularly. We are not pursued. If he failed, then at least he might have taken them with him. And if he succeeded, he will join us soon enough."
Ermatnim smiled.
"And are you concerned, then? Or was this merely a pretext to chastise me?"
Lacomhue did not turn his gaze from the viewscreen. Ermatnim realized that he was studying the debris field.
"Our forces are depleted. Can we truly take this world?"
"Perhaps. I am not planning on it, however."
Ermatnim gestured to the distant planet.
"No, I want only one thing from this world, and once I have it, we can burn Almace to glass for all I care. Or leave it to the children of the gods, if that is your preference."
Lacomhue laughed softly.
"Not mine, but the gods might well appreciate it."
He looked at Ermatnim.
"Once this is done, there will be a settling of accounts between us, brother. I will have recompense for what I have endured."
"And what have you endured, brother, that was not of your own making?"
Lacomhue frowned.
"Am I to blame, then, for your attempts at provocation?"
Ermatnim made a show of considering this, then shook his head sadly.
"The Urizen had a saying about provocation, did he not? Remind me of it."
Lacomhue's frown deepened.
"Provocation is the soil in which knowledge flourishes."
"And there we are. Wisdom at last."
Ermatnim pushed himself to his feet. Lacomhue's bladeslave grunted and grasped the hilt of its weapon more tightly.
"This game between us is one of provocation. We push against one another, testing and challenging each other. The truth is a garden of forking paths. We have each chosen a path and are determined to lead the other down it. Now I know that my path is the correct one, but so too do you. But the garden is the same, whatever the chosen path."
Lacomhue laughed.
Fine. You wish to speak of truth. Do you truly believe that what you seek will undo Erebus? And if so, that the result will mean a stronger legion?"
He grinned mirthlessly.
"Or will it be our end? That is my fear, brother, that your path leads to the doom of us all, and you are too blind to see it."
Ermatnim frowned.
"I think you underestimate us."
"And I think Corferin has fed you a steady diet of half-truths and spite. Throughout this whole affair, you have insisted on your path, on your truth, to the exclusion of all others. You play the philosopher, but you are nothing of the sort. You want me to walk your path, but you will not even consider mine."
"And why should I? I know Erebus well enough to know that he is not worthy to be my master, nor is he worthy of being yours."
Lacomhue shook his head.
"That is not for such as you or I to say. The gods choose us. We do not choose them."
"There, at least, we agree."
Ermatnim crossed his arms.
"You are right. When this is done, all accounts will be settled. Not just between us, but for the Legion as a whole. All secrets will be brought to light, all truths revealed. An apocalypse, in the ancient sense of the word." Then you will know the truth as I know it.
Or you will know my truth,
Lacrimieux said pugnaciously.
We shall see. For now, brother, you have your orders. See to them.
Lacrimieux's lip curled in a sneer.
Gloria aeterna, brother.
Gloria aeterna, Lacrimieux.
Lacrimieux gestured to his blade slave and turned to depart. Amatlim let him get halfway to the steps and then said,
Yattle, stay.
Yattle hesitated, but Lacrimieux nodded and the warrior relaxed. As the Dark Apostle departed, Yattle turned to meet Amatlim's gaze.
You owe me a debt, Amatlim said. You recall this?
Yes.
Yattle bowed his head.
What would you have of me, my lord?
The way he asked the questions said he already knew. Amatlim had little sympathy for him. Yattle was ambitious and foolish in equal measure. Such men soon fell afoul of the wicked and the wise alike.
I think you know.
Yattle paused.
Lacrimieux is loyal, my lord.
I suggest learning how to dissemble, if you wish to have a future as a provocateur, brother.
He is not loyal. He is a blade at my back, and I grow tired of waiting for him to strike, so I will do it first. Kill him. Kill him and be exalted in my sight. Will you do this?
Amatlim knew what Yattle's answer would be, even before he'd asked the question. Yattle would make the attempt, because he knew Amatlim would compensate him fairly, and because he feared the consequences if he said no.
I live but to serve the chosen of the gods, my lord,
Yattle said, head bowed. Amatlim laughed.
A very careful choice of words. The Urizun would approve.
He gestured dismissively.
Go. I leave the details to you. You were blunt with him, Apis said. Was that wise? He might just tell Lacrimieux. I have no doubt he will. And even if he doesn't, Lacrimieux will suspect him regardless. He might even attempt to kill him. Poor Yattle will be forced to defend himself.
Apis frowned.
You don't care if he succeeds, do you?
No. I simply want Lacrimieux preoccupied until we have succeeded in our quest.
Why not simply kill him?
Amatlim sat down in his throne. He considered his words before replying.
Because I am not yet sure which of us is on the right path through the garden.